Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday, and I hope you had a good week. We are ready to jump into another weekend. First hour was fascinating tonight, and don't underestimate the power of that product. It is extraordinary, and we're going to have the scientist who invented it on here in the next couple of weeks. It should be a fascinating program. The actual Russian scientist, the doctor, who put this together, and it has helped so many people in the Chernobyl disaster area, and now it's available for all Americans. So it's called BioAge, and it's right there on the homepage at Rentz.com. Now, our guest tonight in our second conversation is a very unusual man. He is a politician in England. His name is Simon Parkes. But his upbringing and his life in general have been, shall we say, not normal. Simon, are you there?
Yes, lovely to speak to you.
Well, thanks so much for getting up early. It's really a pleasure to have you back. It's 3 a.m. over there. I don't know. I guess maybe getting up isn't the right word. Maybe you just stayed up. I don't know.
I did get some sleep, Jeff.
Good, good. All right, well, we had such a response from so many people when you were on last time. I asked you to come back a week later, and here you are. People, in one instance, I remember, of all the folks who wrote, one person was actually moved to a little teary-eyed at the end. They were touched. What you had to say was something that many of them, I think, perhaps have experienced to some degree, or have ancient memories of. We don't know how deep this all goes, but you are an unusual man. Where were we last time in your recollection? Where would you like to start, Simon?
Well, I think, Jeff, we touched on lots of different subjects. Because we only had the hour, I think we were dipping in and out. I can't really remember where we finished.
We finished, I think, one of the most interesting things I recall was when you were picked up in the crib at the age of, I guess, 3 months, and you noticed that the hands picking you up were green, and you were picked up, and your head kind of lolled back, and then it kind of fell forward. You're just a little tyke at 3 months, and you saw the face of someone who was speaking telepathically to you. And it's quite remarkable for you to be able to recall something that happened to you at 3 months of age.
Yeah.
In and of itself. Now, this was a mantis, for you newcomers who did not hear Simon last time. A mantis or a mantoid. We have a number of groups of different kinds of intelligent life forms visiting here. ETs. We could call it a taxonomy of ETs. We did talk about reptilians last time. We talked about grays. We talked a little bit about the shadow people. We talked about the mantids. We talked about a number of them. Now, your belief is, and Simon had a mom who was his earth mom, so to speak, and he also had a mom which was of the mantis race. And which one, in your view, Simon, was the dominant parent?
An interesting question, Jeff. Clearly, the ET is a dominant parent because having spent so many years with them, I think took on their way of being. They're very quiet. They're very stern. They're not nasty or angry. They're just very quiet and very straight-faced. And I think when you grow up with creatures like that, you contrast the human side of your life with the ET side, and you can see that one side is very advanced, one side is quite ahead. And I think in my case, I threw my lot in, perhaps is the best way to describe it, with what I saw was the dominant culture. So the ET side would have been the dominant side, Jeff.
So what role did your Earth mom play? She must have had knowledge of this interaction. She must have known her bounds. Did she biologically birth you? She must have.
Yes. Yes, there's no question of that.
Uh-huh.
She would never speak on the subject to me about it. The relationship I had with my mum, my human mum, was not a standard relationship. In all the time that we lived together, you must understand that she was a single parent. My father left the family when I was about 1 year old. And she never remarried. And in fact, she never had another boyfriend. So it was just her and me. And whenever we would eat, as a school child, she would go and prepare the evening meal, or the daytime meal if it was at weekend. And she would never eat with me. She would go into the kitchen, and I would eat in the front room. I never once sat down in the same room with her and ate. Her job was to feed me and clothe me. That was basically what her role was.
And she knew that at some level. How do you think she was... How did she become aware of her role in terms of raising you? There's somebody had to talk to her somehow.
I think she'd agreed to this a long time ago. I think she agreed to do this because she was... Her relationship with me was not easy. I remember at one time when I was... I don't want to give you the wrong impression. I mean, she did care for me very much. She didn't love me. I remember one time she got quite angry. There were some guests or friends around, and I remember she did actually strike me. And she said, "That's for what you are, and that's for what you will become." So I think she was very mixed in her emotions. But she did do her job very well. You know, I never went hungry, and I was never cold. So she certainly discharged her duties correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But we would never discuss anything openly. The only time I think we did, apart from the secret document that we talked about last time, was when I had my very big UFO experience, where I saw my first very large spaceship. And she was the only person who didn't laugh at me. When I described what I had seen, she just went, okay, that sounds about right. Where everybody else was incredulous or tried to explain it away, she would become very uncomfortable and just say, "Yes, that's probably what you've seen." And she tried to drop me a crumb trail, as we say here in England. She tried to tip me off. So when a guy called Von Daniken wrote his books on UFOs...
Eric Von Daniken, yes.
Yeah, a film was made in 1970, I think. She took me to see that film, and it was serialized. His books were serialized in a newspaper, and she cut them all out for me and kept them. And I think now when I look back on it, she was trying to lead me on, trying to assist me without actually sitting down and talking to me about it. And she was doing what she saw was the right way to steer me. So it was a very unusual relationship, Jeff.
I'd say. So when your mom and you would be together, did you feel in your heart a bond with her, or was it kind of bifurcated? Did you have a certain set of feelings for her and another set of feelings for your mantis mom? This is a because little kids love their moms, and it's a tough situation to sort out.
Yeah,
yes,
when
yes.
When I was little, I'm sure I did, because you know, I think as I said in my last chat with you, that until I was about 5 or 6. Then I used to tell everybody that I had two mothers. And by the time I reached the age of awareness, probably about 6 or 7, I realized that this wasn't socially acceptable. It just was causing aggravation. But in the ET world, when I was with my, what I'd call my mantid parent, one example where a little gray creature appears, and I get all embarrassed, and I go behind my mantid mother, and I raise his purple cloak that he wears, and I cover my face with it because I'm embarrassed. And the family, a human family, always said that up to the age of about 5 or 6, when I would be out in the town with my mother, and she'd meet someone and would chat, I would go and hide behind my mother, who never wore pants. In those days, you wore a dress or a skirt. And I would again lift her skirt to try and hide my face. So I was somewhat confused between the two roles of our mother until I got to about 6 or 7, and then I was able to split them into two separate groups.
Okay. Now, this idea of seeing your mantis mom, what will we call her? We need a name for her.
Well, to be honest, she is mum. He is mum.
Is it a she, he, is it a...
No, it's very confusing, this, Jeff. It is a he.
Okay.
There,
it's a mommy, it's a mom and a dad together. Or was it more just of a mum?
What tends to happen is that when E.T., in particular a mantis, wants to make contact with a human, I think we talked about this last time, that they want to get in when you're young.
Yes.
They need to get in when you're young. And because of the way humans are, it's the female, it's the mother that provides the love and the support. And so what these creatures will do is they will pass themselves off as a female member of your family. There isn't a lot of research, but I did actually, one of the few times I did go researching. And there's a little bit out there on the internet where a guy had collated a number of mantid reports from children. And in five or six cases, the young kids had reported that they'd seen this, and they're all in America, they'd seen this bug-like creature who said that it was their grandmother or their auntie or their mum, and most of the kids didn't fall for it. And they would say, you're not my mum. And it's obviously what they'll do. They'll come to you as a young kid and try and pass themselves off. However, it is possible that a small genetic piece of material is transferred to the child when that child's in its own mother's womb.
Mm-hmm.
And this bit of genetic material, Jeff, need only be the size of a pinhead.
Would this be done perhaps at inception? Would it be done by a later visit to a craft and your mom would have been abducted? How would that genetic material
be? I would think that I would still be in my human mother's womb.
Uh-huh.
I would think so. The reason I say that is my very, very earliest memory before the crib is actually in my mother's womb. Now, I know that's going to be really hard for your listeners to grasp. It's something that, you know, we just don't have that sort of experience. But I definitely have an experience of seeing a face being projected into my mind and suddenly realizing that I'm not alone. There's much more to the world. There's a huge amount to the world that I just never even grasped. So I'm not even born. And something has made contact, and I'm just extremely happy. I'm not scared, and then it goes, and then I just sort of switch off again. I've no memory of being born at all. The next physical memory is the one where I'm in the crib. So I think contact was made when I was actually in my human mother's womb.
Uh-huh.
And what I was going on to say was that if a tiny, tiny piece of genetic material is added, just literally can be a pinhead. So in effect, it makes no difference whatsoever, but it allows whoever donated that genetic material to legally claim to be a parent. And I think that they'll often do that because their claims need to stand up.
Very good. Now, as a young boy, okay, when was the first time you remember being taken onto a craft?
1963.
Which would have been what age?
3.5.
Okay. And how did that circumstance come about, Simon?
At the time we lived in a place in England called Hove, and it was a flat that mother had had, and I don't know where my human mother was. I'm 3.5, and I'm just on my own. She's gone. She's not there. And, again, this is going to sound really crazy, but a clown... I can only describe it as a clown walks through the wall and stands in front of me.
Oh, I tell you, you probably have heard the clown story before.
Okay.
They appear as clowns often. We think clowns are funny.
Yes.
Clowns have always creeped me out. I don't like clowns. A lot of abductees don't like clowns because they realize it's a fake. It's an E.T.
Yeah. Okay, well, he comes into the room, and is beautifully dressed in my head. You know, he appears to be quite very, very clownish. And I just freak out. And it's odd, because even at this stage at 3.5, I have some sort of link with the creature, because I can tell it's confused. It doesn't understand why I'm scared. And it sends an image to my mind, and it shows me an image of a big top, lots of kids, all sitting around the ringside, and clowns all throwing custard pies and just fooling around. But what it doesn't get is that in a big top with 100 kids, that's funny. But when something walks through your wall, it ain't funny. So it doesn't work, and I'm screaming. And in my mind, it changes, and it changes into a police officer. But it's the costume's not right.
Uh-huh.
And again, it's trying to send me an image of reassuring me. It's trying to say, you know, policemen are good. You know, why are you screaming? And I try to run towards the door, and it moves to cut me off. It doesn't move its legs. It just glides, literally glides across the floor, cuts me off. So now I'm really absolutely just hysterical. And I run behind the sofa, behind the settee, and I get myself down into the fetal position. I'm just hiding my head.
Uh-huh.
And it pokes its head over the sofa, and I see it. And the thing is, it doesn't have a human face. It has a face which looks for all intents and purposes like a cross between a human and a lion. And I obviously, at this point, I've just lost it, as they say. I'm just absolutely hysterical. And then I hear Mum's voice.
Mm-hmm.
This is the voice I know, and it says to me, "Don't be scared. Nobody will ever harm you. Look at me." And this is repeated. "Don't be scared. No one will ever harm you. Look at me." And I put my look over the edge of the sofa, and I see, because they're tall, so I don't see its whole body. I just see a green hand holding a rod, silver rod, and then the rod goes blue. And it's quite odd, because it's not just like you switch a flashlight on. This has facets, like crystal facets all around the edge, and each facet activates, but not slowly, but quickly. So it's boom, 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 boom. Each facet activates blue light. I get a blue light shone straight in the face, and the very next thing I can remember is I'm actually on my back, floating, weird, floating out of the room,
uh-huh.
And all the walls are see-through, and I look up, and I see the ceiling, and I think, how am I going to get through the ceiling? But I have no memory of getting through the ceiling. The next thing I know is I'm on a spaceship. So that was 3.5, 1963.
When you're in there as a 3.5-year-old in a spaceship,
yeah.
What do you see? What do you remember? I think as a youngster, what you're suggesting is you have quite good recall, and obviously intellectually you're well beyond your months.
Yes, but I think that's because they've done things to my mind, Jeff. I tell you what I remember, it's going to make you laugh. No dust. No dust. We lived in human mum and I lived in a Victorian flat, a big house divided into apartments. These spaceships, no dust at all, no wooden furniture, everything is beautiful, shiny metal. No angles, no corners, everything's round. And the lighting, to describe the lighting to you, here on Earth, in your home, you have hot spots of light wherever your light is, but where they are, it's the same level of light throughout each room. And when you look up, you don't actually see any traditional lighting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different concept of lighting and heating.
Right. Is it pretty in there? What is it like?
No. Right. To me, it reminds me of standing in a desert, barren, or here where I live in North Yorkshire, we have what we call the moors, where you don't see anybody for many, many miles, and the land's quite barren.
The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yes, but that's down in the southwest of England.
Right. Still a moor, though.
It's exactly right. But the spaceships then are devoid of junk. They're devoid of clutter. They are smooth surfaces. And in fact, it would be wrong to have anything blocking the way or looking out of place. So it's very utilitarian.
Got it. All right. But equipment, lights?
Yep.
Consoles?
As we know it.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Consoles? Control panels?
Yes,
lights?
Only in the control section.
Okay.
Do you want me to describe them?
Yes, please.
Okie doke. No flashing lights. Think of Star Trek. Nothing like that at all. Think of our own technology. No buttons. No switches.
Mm-hmm.
No rivets.
Mm-hmm.
No wires. Big screens, big flat screens.
Lots of them?
Normally three, one ahead, one to the left, and one to the right.
All right.
Sometimes there's a what I call an installation, which, how can I describe this? In the middle of the floor, imagine, you know, like a submarine's periscope goes up and down, but imagine instead of a periscope, you've got sort of like a capsule, and you've got two entities that sit one on top of each other almost, and this thing rises and falls from the floor. It's to save space. So you've actually got the floor you walk on can actually rise up, or part of that can rise up as a sort of a like a tin can shape. And in the cylinder, you can have entities in there operating machinery. The actual consoles, basically what you do is you just put your hand on a plate. The plates I saw were arch-shaped, not finger-shaped. There wasn't an indentation for fingers. It's just a plate delineated by an arch shape. And you put the right hand on this one and your left hand on that one. And then you have a device in the middle which you can look at, and it will make contact with your body and your mind, and there's an intelligence on the craft which will then communicate with you, and you can steer the ship with your thoughts. But you can't do it individually, you have to do it as part of a collective.
Fascinating. So when you say collective, it's almost as if the collective consciousness of the occupants of the ship, the crew, are in harmony with the machine itself.
That's exactly right. You can't have said that, Jeff, unless you unless you've talked to other people or you've read something. But that's exactly what it is, because each pilot of a craft is biologically linked
to the craft.
Pardon?
To the craft.
Yes, yes. In fact, the craft will know each individual.
I understand.
Each individual has a task. So if you get people taken out, you can't actually do certain tasks, and it's harder for the remaining crew to take over other tasks. And if you get to a critical number of three, if you go below three, you can't fly a craft, a big craft. You can't do it because you just haven't got the ability to fly it. You need
more. How interesting.
Three or more.
How interesting. Wow. So here we have the evolution of living intelligence blended to a specifically designed machine that actually is melded to the consciousness of the people to whom it has been assigned and created for. This is like, this is amazing. It's
correct.
Like a...
In fact, although it's going to sound a bit of a cheat, I often think that these very brilliant guys in Hollywood do have access to information of the highest security nature, because in the film Matrix, the characters have a thing that they plug into the back of their head, and I can actually tell you that that's what I've seen. To get direct access to a creature's brain, a device actually plugs in to the back of the head so that it can be linked directly to the computer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, hold on just a second, if you will, Simon. We have to take a short break, and we'll come right back. Simon Parks is a politician and running for public office, and he has been quite successful, and he is very well respected and looked up to and admired. But he has a past that he has chosen not to hide, and he brings it forward. How let's take just a pause in the narrative and look at your professional human career. How has that gone for you?
I left London in 1999. I think if I'd stayed in our capital city, and would have possibly risen quite high. Because, you know yourselves, in the big metropolis, that's where the opportunities are. But I had to decide what was important to my life. I'd made some pledges to my electorate, and I promised that I wouldn't leave office until I'd fulfilled those personal pledges. And in one term of office, it wasn't enough. I hadn't completed it, so I stood for a second term of office and was re-elected with an increased majority. And then midway through that second term of office as a city councillor, my pledges were to remove the drug dealers from a big housing housing complex that fell inside my political area. And my other pledge was to improve the social housing in Britain. We have quite a lot of what we call social housing, where poor people live. They can't afford their own home, and it's run by the municipality or the local council. And I wanted to transfer that to I actually transferred it to a Christian housing association. This is a company that has a Christian bias, ethos, and would run social housing. And when I did that, I'd completed all my pledges. And so I left office, moved, and I thought, well, I've done it now. I've had quite high office, and I won't get back involved. But you know what? You see things going on in the newspapers, and you think, oh, that can't be right. And in the end, you get back involved. And, and I stood again for re-election here in the new town where I live, and I was elected. So I'm back doing what I do best.
So you really do love to serve the interests of your constituents and your community. I mean, that's something you really
people,
have.
People don't scare me. People's problems don't scare me. There's an awful lot of politicians who say all the right things, and then when someone goes to help, they find every excuse not to help them. I'm not like that.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I'm wondering if anyone has ever mounted a serious challenge to you predicated on your background.
No. No, I think what tends to happen is people who haven't met me, they form an opinion, he's a nut or he's a crank, and then they meet me, and then after they've met me, they walk away shaking their head thinking, oh, well, he seems a pretty decent down-to-earth guy. Perhaps there's a lot of truth in what he says. Also because my record of service to the electorate was immaculate, you can't be attacked on that. And what I have found is if people attack you on a personal level, it generally backfires because other people say, well, what's that got to do with
his ability to serve our community, our town,
exactly,
our city,
so,
of course.
No, I've not had that at all.
Wow, interesting. Well, your voice speaks very eloquently, and you have a calmness in your voice that I've not heard very often. It's a special kind of a voice, and I've been doing this for a long time.
Okay.
And I think when you speak, it must encourage and imbue the people, the listener, with a sense that they are in honorable, honest, secure hands, so to speak.
It's odd you say that because the number of times when the telephone has rung, I've answered it, and somebody on the other end is saying, is that an answer phone? Am I speaking to an answer phone or a person?
And how interesting.
What they say is that the voice, my voice at the other end, mm-hmm. seems so calm, mm-hmm. they can't believe it's a human. And what I would say is that's probably why I can cope with all this interaction from extraterrestrials, because I don't run kicking and screaming out the room. And I think that that calmness is what has saved me and kept me on the straight and narrow.
Very interesting. All right, let's go back to the story. Now, we've been up in the ship and 3.5 years of age. How often are you seeing... Now, this is a male mantis, a male mantid. But it's your mom. It's for all intents and purposes, it's your real mother.
Correct.
How often do you see your mantis mom?
Probably monthly.
For how many hours?
Oh, it's so hard to tell because...
Does he take you away? Do you go on trips? Do you spend time just at home? Where are these meetings? Are they perhaps just telepathic meetings sometimes?
That's very interesting. There are two types of meetings. One is the physical, and you've just alluded to it there. There's the sort of etheric, the ether, type of meeting that isn't on the physical body. I've had contact in the homes wherever I've lived. They'll be in the house, or they'll come and actually physically take me onto a ship, or I've been taken and gone underground in the earth where there are caverns.
How would you transit from your home to these underground caverns?
I beg your pardon, Jeff, I didn't hear you.
How would you transit? How would you travel to the underground caverns?
several ways. One would be what I've called interdimensional. If your listeners can just imagine, just close their eyes for a moment.
Yes.
And imagine wherever they live, their room, and imagine somebody just literally walking into their room. I don't mean walking in through the front door, Jeff, or the side door.
Uh-huh.
In the middle of the room, imagine you saw one leg just appear.
I see.
And then another leg just appear, uh-huh. And then an arm uh-huh. in the middle uh-huh. of the room, and a body. They just almost step into your reality.
I understand.
That's one way.
Uh-huh.
The second way would be where I'm sort of shepherded. It might be nighttime. I wake up suddenly, and there's a face about 3 inches of my face staring at me intently.
What face? What is it? Is it Simon? Is it the face of your mum?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If a little grey does that, they can't coordinate, and I'll usually end up striking them or pushing them away.
Yeah, you said that last time. That's very interesting. And there are
I don't get on with them at all.
There are people over the years I've interviewed who have physically not been subdued by them and have tried to beat the hell out of them, let me put it that way.
Yeah, I can understand that. I have. Okay. To my mindset, when my mindset is that the Greys' job is to serve, I feel desperately sorry for the Greys because they are trapped in an unending circle. They cannot get out of this servitude. They are in prison. They must do what they're told. They've been enslaved, basically. Having said that, they're not actually particularly nice. I don't have any time for them. So if I'm got out of bed, I was told as a very young boy, don't wear clothes, don't wear pajamas. You've been sleep naked because it makes it easier for us and it makes it harder for you.
Hmm.
So I've never, since a very young boy, ever gone to bed with pajamas.
Hmm.
So I get out of bed, and then a circle of light will appear somewhere in the room, and I have to stand inside that circle, always facing a window, never a brick wall. And then my ET mum, he will put his hand out and hold my hand. And again, your listeners are going to find this really, really difficult, because most stories of abductions are people carried kicking and screaming, and this is just totally the opposite. And I will turn to my ET mum and I'll say, let's go, are you ready, what are we going to do today?
Now this is an 8 or 9 foot tall, very thin ET mum who reaches down with a four-fingered hand, I assume, and takes your hand, or do you just walk together?
Oh no, always hold my hand, always.
Even
fact,
now,
as an,
even
as
even
an
now?
Older fella,
okay.
We don't hold hands so much now because I'm a grown man. But you know what? There have been occasions where I've said things to him like, "Do you remember when I was little and you used to hold my hand?" And he'll stop and he'll look at me and he's trying to work out what I'm saying, and then the penny will drop and then he'll reach out and take my hand, and we'll relive when I was a small child. And then he'll walk along with me for a little bit. But generally, no, we don't hold hands anymore, but we always embrace when we meet, and we're always very sad when we have to part.
Well, very fascinating story. The idea of going off, and are these kind of like mom and child outings? to visit caverns, or just for the interest of it?
Yeah, it feels very similar to that. I mean, I always look forward to them because they're always exciting. There's always something exciting for me to learn or do or see or have some information imparted to me. And it, as I grew up, I looked forward to it because it was so much more interesting than my boring, mundane life here. Compared to what I do with them, it's so boring. And sometimes, you know, when I'm vacuuming the house, because I'm very good, I vacuum the house, and I do the washing. and I'm doing that, and I'm thinking, uh-huh. Oh, my God, why am I doing this when I could be up on a spaceship or I could be on a planet? And you have to watch it, because otherwise sometimes you can become depressed because you think, well, why the heck am I involved in this drudgery when I could be doing all this other exciting stuff? And I know that for a lot of people who experience it becomes a problem. I've been quite successful in splitting the two and saying, well, this is what I do here. This is my role. This is what I need to do. And when they come and get me, that's a different life.
That's
but yeah, I think it was mm-hmm. It's very much a case of my parent taking me out to do something interesting. Yeah, I agree with that.
Well, that's remarkable. I wonder if that's a trait that your mom picked up from observing human mothers and fathers and their children, or if it's something that is intrinsic to their culture. The idea of being a good parent, having fun interacting with a child, or is it something that they're learning about and trying to experience and feel by enacting what they see going on here?
It's very tricky, I think, to be honest, that they have interacted with humans for so many thousands of years. They probably know us better than we know ourselves. And in many cases, they don't have the same emotions that we have, but they know its importance. And I'll give you an example, Jeff. When I was learning to be telepathic, I was told, don't obviously speak with your mouth, and don't make a hand gesture unless it's backed up with a telepathic communication. On Earth, and different races on Earth, use their hands to reinforce what they verbally say. The Italians are great at that. Their hands go all over the place. But an ET would be quite happy just to stand there with his arms or her arms down by their side and just have a conversation with you. But they know that humans require visually to see the hands moving to reinforce a communication. And so they'll actually mimic that to make you more comfortable. But that's only if they want to put themselves out for you. I mean, if you're one of these poor people that's taken and stuck on an operating table, prodded about a little bit, and then dumped back home, they're not going to put any of the niceties in on that. And this is what causes so much harm, where an individual says, well, they never spoke to me. They never told me what they were doing. And that individual becomes a victim. This is where you get the abduction cycles from. For some reason that I still don't fully understand, that's never been my take on it. I've never been experienced to that. And they would always ask me. They will say to me, can we do this to you? Are we all right to do that to you? Do you allow this? And so it's been difficult for me when meeting other experiences, because I haven't found a single person with an experience that comes anything like near mine. And I have to be very careful that I don't go telling them how great it is and how wonderful and what I saw, when their life is all about a situation that they just don't understand. So I have to be very circumspect, and I have to be very careful when talking to people. And I try to understand their perspective, because they don't have the wider knowledge that I have.
Interesting. Okay. 3.5 years old, and your first trip on a ship. How many times do you think you've been on a craft in your life?
Oh, good Lord.
Hundreds?
Yes. Oh, it has to be. Uh-huh. And I mean, I don't think I remember them all anyway.
No.
I think I only remember a fraction of what I've done.
And you did mention that you felt you had been taken to, or you recall having been taken to other planets.
Yes, I have.
Where are these other planets? Do you have any idea? Are they in the Milky Way? Do they tell you?
No, they may not even be in the same dimension. I mean, I think we've got to get out of the idea of looking at a telescope and looking at planets and saying, well, I think we come from there or they come from there. Undoubtedly, on some of those planets, deep in space, there is life. But there's also a separate dimension where there are planets or a different universe where beings have grown up at a different speed to us, and hence they're far more advanced down the road. So you've got your traditional aspect of looking at the night sky and saying, look at those stars, I wonder if there's any life on that. But you've got this harder aspect of trying to understand that literally if you stand in your front room and you stretch your right hand out and imagine that somewhere there's they call it a parallel universe. I don't know about parallel universe yet, but if you stretch your hand out, there is another dimension. Because I've seen these creatures actually enter my reality, not by a spaceship sometimes, but literally just appearing in the room. Now, that's not trick of magic, that's science, that's technology. And somehow these creatures can access our world, our reality, not in a traditional way of a flying saucer landing on your front garden, but actually just breaking through into this reality. So there are a number of ways that different beings can enter and make contact with you.
Fascinating. Now, your mom took you on the craft. Do you remember, as you're in the craft, sitting, standing, as you're being driven, wherever you've flown to, if flying is the right term, do you remember looking at the three screens? Did they show space that you were traveling through? Did it appear to be stars and planets moving past you, you know, like the movies, real quick? Or did it seem that you were looking at other things? Were they technical instrument readings or something to do with the way the ship was operating? There are three screens up there, and there are three pilots, you said.
No, that's the minimum number you need.
Okay, that's right. That's the minimum number. It could be the whole crew, for that matter, 15 or 20.
Right.
In fact, one wonders if the more people on board, perhaps the more performance the craft will yield.
Yes, the more tasks you can undertake.
Yes.
Some of these craft aren't just spacecraft. They are they're like political biospheres. They are craft that go out and interact with a whole range of races. They're not just there to shoot them up. They're actually there to open dialogue. Let me talk about this experience in 1971, because that's when I was on the craft, and that was a teardrop-shaped craft. So not a traditional disc, but a teardrop shape. And the reptilians, they tend to be the guards, the soldiers, and reptilians are incredibly steeped in ritual and ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And they have important jobs, as they see it, and they're called room keepers, or the keeper of the room. So when you have, in a spaceship, sensitive areas, these guys will guard those areas. And you have to get past them into their room, and they're hugely proud of their job. So literally, their job is just to keep that room, and they act as a doorkeeper. So this is the control room, and Mum took me, and there was a reptilian. He was dark greeny black, naked. And for the information of your listeners, reptilian's genitalia are hidden behind a flap of skin.
All right.
And what this one did was he walked towards me and lifted me up and sniffed me. Actually sniffed me.
Did it sound like a snake exhaling and inhaling? Or
no,
did it sound
no,
more
no,
human?
No, it wasn't. It was just a sniff, because he was clearly wanting to remember my smell.
I got
Very
it.
Very interesting.
How fascinating,
When he recognized me, he then rubbed his face against my face. Do you know when a domestic cat rubs its face against a table leg?
Yes.
It's just like that. Just like that. He rubbed his face against my face.
And how old were you, Simon, at that time, approximately? How old?
How old was I?
During that
11,
event.
11 and a half.
Okay. Now, this reptilian, and again, they, I think you said they wear no uniforms, nothing.
Stop. Right. They wear some uniforms, but that's more to do with ceremony.
Okay.
But generally, they're naked.
All right. And the color and their skin, does it have scale-like lines on it? It does look reptilian. What color what color would you describe the skin as?
It depends which reptilian. They are different.
Okay.
The Draconis, these are the warriors, the soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you take a paint pot of green and black.
Yes.
And mix it, make it more green than black.
Yes.
That's the color. They're the soldiers.
Very interesting. All right. Yep. So you were sniffed by a reptilian. And not many people can say that.
Soldier. Uh-huh. And I passed the test. So the door opens, a traditional steel door slides along, and the first thing I'm greeted with is the most beautiful aspect. There's a big viewing screen. I'll give you some, this 30 foot in length, and maybe 10 foot in height. And there's the earth, and at this stage, I don't know whether that is a genuine window, and I'm looking out the window at the earth, or whether that's a viewing screen that's projecting the earth, that it doesn't necessarily mean that we're over the earth. So you have to be careful. You can't jump to conclusions. So there's the beautiful earth. And Jeff, the earth is so beautiful. It's blue and green, and the clouds go around it, and the aura around the earth, it's right by the planet, it's sort of white, and then it goes yellow and red. It's the most incredible, beautiful picture that anyone could ever see. Anyway, there's six chairs around consoles, around these screens. It's semicircular. And at this stage of the game, there's nobody there, just these empty chairs. And the reptilian says to me, do you want to sit? So I get up and I sit on the chair. And it's not the most important chair, because in the middle of the room, there's a big, big chair. And it reminds me of a dentist's chair.
Huh.
So it's really huge, overblown, a massive chair.
Yeah.
And then the reptilian says, would you like to command? And I look to Mum, and Mum says, yes, you can do
it. Wow.
And I get onto this chair. I have to scramble onto it. It's so big.
Uh-huh.
Are you going for a commercial break now?
Yes, we are. Very good ears.
That's fine.
Thank you.
That's fine. You go and do that.
That's fascinating. We'll come back and reset scene in just a few minutes with the remarkable, gracious Simon Parks from England. Okay, and welcome back. We're talking with a remarkable man, Simon Parks, who again is a city councilman in his town in England, and he has served at various levels in larger markets than that. But he is telling us a story that very few people will honestly be able to, I think, accept easily, but you listen to the man and listen to his voice and ask yourself, and I know you folks out there, our audience, Simon, is the best. They are open-minded, they are wise, and they are very interested in hearing unusual and interesting people like yourself. They do not pass judgment easily, they think. And I think in your voice they are hearing what I have always called the ring of truth. That's it's an acid test in a way for those who are sensitive to the sounds that other people make when they're communicating. And it's quite clear and quite evident that what you're relating to us is the kind of material that makes me personally wish I only could have been there to experience a little bit of it. It's amazing.
Right, thank you, Jeff. I went public with this simply because I could no longer keep a lie. I couldn't pretend to be something I wasn't.
For our listeners, when did you go public with this? Just so that they have the context of everything and the sequence.
Last year, when I agreed to be interviewed for 4 hours of interview on YouTube. So last year.
Very good. Okay. Now, By the way, you sound amazingly fresh. It's 4 a.m. in the UK.
When you have interactions, as I do, they can come for you at any time, and I'm very used to having very little sleep.
When was the last time they came to you?
I know that the last time I can definitely remember was 3 weeks ago.
What happened? What kind of a visit was it?
I had a friend with me. We'd just come back from the hypermarket, the supermarket.
Uh-huh.
And we were driving, and we got back to where we were staying, and my friend says to me, "That's crazy," she says to me, "we've got back very quickly." And I'm driving, and I said, "Well, what do you mean we've got back quickly?" And she said, "Well, we've got back too quick." And I said, "Oh, look, the journey back always seems quicker than the journey going out."
You were covering up, weren't you, Simon?
Uh-huh. Pardon?
You were covering up, it sounds like.
No. I see, the problem is, mm-hmm. this stuff happens to me so regular mm-hmm. that I no longer pick it up sometimes.
Really?
It's so normal that it doesn't stand out anymore.
Interesting.
To people who don't have it as a regular thing, it stands out. And the upshot of it was that she said, "This is wrong. We've got back in 10 minutes. The journey is half an hour." And we both looked at each other, and there was a whole village which we should have driven through, and the whole section of road, we both had no recollection of uh-huh. coming back. It's actually called the village of Cloughton. Cloughton is the name of the village where we live. And we did not come back through that village. And all I can remember, we came out of the supermarket, we drove for about 5 miles,
mm-hmm.
and then we both have a blank in our memory. And then the next thing I remember, I'm on the road, and there's a big lorry coming towards me, and it's flashing its headlights at me.
Mm-hmm.
Flash, flash, flash.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember turning to my passenger and saying, "Oh, I must have my headlights on, and I shouldn't have them on so bright or something." And then after that, it's a normal drive, and we both realized that we were taken in the motor car, and the crazy thing was that when we got back, my passenger said to me, "I feel taller." I said, "What do you mean you feel taller?" She said, "I feel taller." So we measured her. And she was about an inch and a half taller than she should have been. And the next day, she'd shrunk a half inch, and the day after that, she'd gone back to a normal height. But if she hadn't have said to me, mm-hmm. "Something's wrong here," I mm-hmm. wouldn't have picked it up myself.
How interesting. To what do we attribute the increase in height? Different gravity, different
zero environment? Gravity. Yeah, zero mm-hmm. gravity.
Mm-hmm.
You know yourself, I'm sure, that in the morning, humans are taller because their bones are not compressed.
Right.
So if you jump out of bed first thing and measure yourself, you'll actually be taller than 2 or 3 hours later when gravity has compressed you slightly.
Right. Right.
I'm sure the Apollo astronauts actually grew a little bit taller.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of physiological things that they discovered about being in zero G through that program. Of course, bone density loss was one of them and other things.
Right.
I wonder, does your female passenger understand what may have happened to her?
No, she has no memory of that. When we got back, she was absolutely sweating. Her jacket was disgusting. She mm-hmm. had to have that dry cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever happened mm-hmm. scared her to death.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't sweating at all.
No, you're
but
used
that's
to
just
it.
A sign yeah. of how used to it all I am.
Yes.
I only have a very small memory, myself, of the matter. A big, big, big hall. It's a ship, but it's like being inside an aircraft carrier. A massive, massive room. And down the middle, what appear to be huge machines. Huge machines down, dividing this room in two. And I remember saying to her, "Okay, you go that way, and I'll go this way. And we'll meet up at the bottom." And she looks at me and says, "I'm not leaving your side," and grabs my arm. Again, it just shows how at ease I am in these situations, because what I was saying to her is, "Look, we should be met. So somebody should be here to meet us. There's nobody here. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll split up and we'll go and find who we're meeting. And of course, she's absolutely freaking out. So I do have that memory, but I don't have any more. But that'll come back to me in the days to come, I think.
Fascinating, indeed. At this point in your life, and even before, when you're a younger man, what was the meaning, the significance of all the interactions, of all the visits, of all the abductions, if you will, the contacts? What were they doing with you, Simon? I'll get to the punchline here. Did they give you information about what's going to happen to this planet? Did you have visions, or were you shown things about where we're going as a civilization and so forth?
It's not that sort of contact, I'm afraid. A lot of people, Alex Collier is a guy who I've got a lot of respect for.
You do?
It's not the same sort of contact.
Well, Alex Collier was a man, and the unfortunate part of contact for a lot of people is that they're told somehow that you are an ambassador, you're a delegate, you're to tell the planet the truth about us and prepare people, and it doesn't work. Now, you're not doing that at all, and that's what makes your story all the more compelling to me. You haven't been appointed by
them. They've made it very clear that's not what it's about at all.
Right.
And I only get information if I ask point blank. So nobody sort of sits me down and says, we're going to tell you this, that, and the other. The information I get is when I actually put a question to them, and then they respond to that. But to go back, because your point is well made, what on earth, pardon me, what the heck is it all about? Well, over my interactions from a very small boy, they explained it to me over a period of years. So it wasn't a grand sit down, we're going to tell you what it's all about.
Right.
It was a drip effect, because it was such a... They know that as people, we can't take too much. We just can't cope with it. And I think a lot of people have nervous breakdown. And they're very, very conscious.
You mean a lot of contactees, abductees?
Yeah. They're very conscious of that. So what they did over probably a period of 10 or 15 years was slowly let me become aware of exactly what the whole principle of it was. And what they did originally, the creature that I call Mum had a medallion, a medal around his chest. I don't remember if it was a chain or what, but it was a circular medallion. It was a holographic image. And on this holographic image was the tree, go back to Genesis, the tree of knowledge. Not the tree of life, but the tree of knowledge. And on this medallion that he wore around his neck, a human male walks in holographically and sits with his back against the tree. And it just repeats itself over and over and over again. The tree of knowledge, and then a human male sits with his back against the tree. And I was given that medallion.
Wow. You still
have
it?
You going for a break?
No, we'll go right through the break. It's all right.
Okay.
You have the medallion.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And on several different contacts, several different visits, I was given a little bit more knowledge. For instance, when I was 3 and a half and I was on board a spaceship, I was given a paint, I don't know what you call it in the States. We call it a paint box set. You have colored paints and a brush.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I was told, paint a picture. Paint a picture.
Who told you? Who told you that?
Mum. Okay. My ET mum. Paint
All
a
right.
picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a piece of paper, and I paint a green field and a tree. That's all I did. Blue sky, white clouds, green fields, and a tree. And then Mum looks at it and says, something's missing. What's missing? And I look at the picture and I say, me. I should be in the picture. And Mum says, yes, but not yet. And so we went from a situation where I understood a tree, and then a tree with a person, and then after many years, a female walks in to this image, and passes me an apple, and the female says to me, take of the apple and you will see what I see. And over a period of 15 years, I got this image, this reoccurring image, and the mum character refers to me as Adam. In fact, he refers to me as the Adam, not just Adam, but the Adam.
Hmm.
And then I had a number of very, very, what I would call disquieting memories. I don't mean bad memories, just very challenging to my own understanding of Earth history.
Yes.
Which actually very closely relate to Genesis and the Bible. Fascinating way of looking at stuff, but very difficult for me to accept.
Well, the Bible, you mentioned the Bible last time.
Yes.
That it's very important, and its truths are immutable. And tell us more about that.
I did say to your listeners last time that there is a God. There's absolutely no question that there is a God. There is a force that creates and doesn't die and is good. And they accept that entirely. And I think what's heartening from a human perspective is here are these extraterrestrial creatures which are light years ahead of us, but they can't understand God. They can't reach the level of God. And I think that's absolutely wonderful that even with all their technology, they're just as in the dark as we are, although perhaps they have a better
understanding.
How interesting,
yeah. You made that point last time.
Yeah, in terms of the Bible, the overall aspect of what I've been shown is actually correct. I don't want to upset any of your listeners, because religion is a very, very important subject. I've been shown some things that are slightly different from the Bible, but by and large, what the Bible teaches is accurate. And it's a shame that in modern science we don't look on it as history now. We look on the Bible as the Bible, whereas actually it should be in the history section, because it's a very fair, true representation of the early days on this planet.
Well, that's interesting to hear, and will, I think, produce a lot of very profound reactions in people who are listening very carefully, who believe in the Bible.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
I do, because I've now experienced it, and
yes.
My Bible now doesn't sit on the shelf with my other stuff. It actually sits in the history book section. I've moved it to my history shelf.
How much of the Bible was tweaked in the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD? Much?
Yeah, I think I'm not an expert. I wouldn't pretend to be an expert, but what's happened is that when people became so far removed from the original event, they tried to fit it to the lifestyle and the world that they understood at that point. Rather than saying, look, when it was written, it was closer to the happenings of the truth, therefore we should honor that. What they'll do is they'll say, this doesn't quite match the message we want to get across, or it doesn't quite match our times now, so we'd better leave this out or change that. And I think that what happened was that we lost or we had blurred edges of the truth. But I think there were changes.
Well, they allegedly removed all reference to reincarnation, among other things, at 320 to bring people more to bear on instant accountability in terms of the church and its power.
Yeah.
So that was one.
I'm being very careful, because I do not wish to upset your listeners.
No, you won't. These are special people. You can say
whatever
you want.
Okay. I mean, the religions of the East, in terms of reincarnation, are closer to the truth. They've protected their knowledge and their understanding. In the West, we've become so technologically obsessed, and that we'll only believe what we can see and what we can touch. Sadly, we're losing our knowledge. But reincarnation is an absolute vital part. Otherwise, you've got to say to yourself, what the heck are we doing on this Earth? You know, if the sun's just the right distance from the Earth, the moon's just the right distance, everything is you know, just seems to be coincidental. As a human, we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. A plant breathes in carbon dioxide and breathes out oxygen. And so we have a symbiotic relationship. And for anybody to think that this has all come up out of chance, well, I'm sorry, it's not like that. The whole thing was designed and created by an intelligence that's far superior than we will ever grasp. And I think that when the Bible was originally written, it was written almost dictated. I think it was a person or a group of people had access to records that were very close to the truth, but over the thousands of years since the Bible was written, unfortunately, it's been changed.
Well, very good and very interesting, to be sure. Have they spent much time talking about philosophy and philosophical issues with you over the years? Has that come up? Have you asked questions about that? Where do we go when we die? What happens? What is the purpose of life?
Yeah, I've seen images. Very clear.
Well, tell us, please.
Okay, well, I've seen an image of an old man dying, and his spirit, literally like smoke, coming out of his body, and a small newborn baby, and the smoke rising and going straight into the baby.
Where did you see this image, Simon?
That would have been in 1971, before you went for your break. We were talking about that spaceship.
Yes, yes.
I was educated. That's the best way I can describe it. I sat in front of a big, big viewing screen, and a number of images were shown to me to teach me. And this is one element of it, where I was shown the undying circle of life, an old man dying, spirit rising up in the air, going into a baby, and showing that there isn't really death. Physical body dies, but your inside don't die.
Very good. Very good. And this, of course, Sir William Crookes, Oliver Lodge, and other great geniuses of the 18th century were absolutely fascinated with this. And Crookes would record people dying, and they would weigh the body, and there was a claim that there was a slight difference in weight and that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on this side of it, and I don't pretend to be, but so many people claim to be collected by somebody just before they die. Others in the room say that that person smiles and reaches out.
Yes.
And I think that is the case. I certainly do believe in God. I have no problem in believing in it at all. And I think that we've become such physical creatures here in 2012. We only see the physicality. Sadly, we don't look to the spirituality. There are some people who break through the conditioning that exists in our world today, and they ask themselves some very searching questions, and they become more in tune with themselves, and they switch off from the television, and they switch off from some of the things they see on the cinema, and they look into themselves, and they actually realize that they're very important creatures. We are, as human beings, fabulous creatures, and there's so much more to us than modern science actually understands.
Hmm. Well, that's for darn sure. We are in our own right absurdly and ridiculously arrogant about what we think we know.
Yeah.
And we know next to nothing. You talked about someone coming to collect people when they pass on.
Yeah, I think so.
Very interesting film, if some of you folks get a chance to see it. It is called On Borrowed Time, a 1939 film, I believe. Lionel Barrymore was in it, Sir Cedric Hardwick. Very interesting film as the way it portrayed death and passing. Sir Cedric was death, and he would come to people and reach out and touch them, and they would die. Or he would say, it's time to go now. And they would reach over to him, and he would take their hand, and they would die. It was a fascinating film because a young boy tricked death up into an apple tree, and he couldn't come down. I forget what it was, a curse or something, and no one could die. And all of a sudden, no one was dying around the whole world. And anyway, it's a very good movie worth watching if you folks have a chance, called On Borrowed Time. All right, we'll be right back with more time with Simon Parks in a minute. Fascinating conversation with Simon Parks, and we're very much indebted to him for staying up, I mean getting up early, real early. All right, my friend, we have about 20 minutes left or so. What would you like to talk about that you would like our list touched upon yet?
I think maybe the future. I think there's such a lot of speculation about the future.
Speculation, fear, anxiety,
yeah,
stress, depression.
Yeah, worry.
Yeah.
And I can just give you my take on it, and I think your listeners can just put that into the melting pot. And
now, this is your synthesis of life as you've lived it, or is this information that you have been given?
This is what I've been told. Yeah, I don't talk to people about what I've read, because that's pointless. That's just rehashing other stuff. I'll only make it clear what I've had communicated to me.
All right. Very good. We're all ears. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. I think your listeners, I would like your listeners to understand that there are many forms of government that they have. They have an elected government. They have many splinter groups of government. Some of those governments are undoubtedly decent, hardworking men and women who want the best for their country. There are other elements of your government, who are in a very difficult position, having got themselves into quite a pickle, as we say in England, and can't get themselves out of it. And they're the ones who have perhaps gone into an agreement with one branch of the ETs and have built themselves quite an empire, and they see that empire as threatened. And I think that if I had to put some odd figures on the future, I think the human race will be successful and come through the next 5 years. And I put the odds at 60-40, which isn't brilliant, but it's better than it was. So I think 60% chance the human race is going to not have a major war, is not going to have its populations thinned out, and will actually move on to the next stage of our evolution. However, there is still a chance that splinter fragments of government would like to drag the Earth down into a very difficult and upsetting time period. But I with each day that passes, I'm more hopeful, Jeff.
Very good. Well, a little optimism never hurt anything.
Specifics. There are a number of what you'd call greys, but they're not actually greys. There's a better word for them, which is programmed life forms. And you know what? Your human scientists have been far more clever than they've let on. Their cloning has reached the most unprecedented level, and it would not surprise me if at some time in the very near future there's an announcement made that aliens are going to land, and they're dangerous, and suddenly there are going to be images shown on your television screen of your archetypal Hollywood grey alien. And I think that there are elements of warped military, warped mind, who could see some advantage in scaring the population into believing that there was a hostile attack, because it would allow them to have a state of national emergency to take full control and suspend your Bill of Rights. You've got something that no other country has, my friend, and you have the Founding Fathers that gave your country one of the most beautiful things that humans can create, which is freedom and democracy. And it's a real problem to many people because you have a Bill of Rights that you can't assault or take down without it being very obvious that you've done that. And the only way to obviously take down your Bill of Rights is to have such a monumental threat to the United States that everybody would agree that you need to suspend your constitution. So that, I think, was the end game for a number of people, was to suspend your constitution, suspend your Bill of Rights, and to go into a military lockdown, hunkered down state. I'm not necessarily thinking that that's going to be the way forward. I actually think that the people who, for so many years, have called the shot are actually on the back foot. And I think that the destruction of the banking industry, many people in the military and in the intelligence services are rebelling against some of their orders. So Jeff, try and say to your listeners that it's not all doom and gloom. Mm-hmm. I actually think that there's a new sunrise for humanity.
Right.
And
well,
that's basically what I've been told.
That's extraordinary. Well, it won't come soon enough.
Yeah.
It won't come soon enough. The idea of a staged or a faux ET invasion or a real ET invasion has been pushed around for decades here. There is talk now that is the ultimate Trump card to bring world into a one world government modality.
Yeah.
I don't know if ET will be involved with this or it will be our own technology passed off as ET technology. It's hard to tell. What do you think? Will ET be involved with this or will it be us pretending?
Okay. I don't know how much your listeners can take of this. There's going to be a time when portals open on the Earth. Portals. This is a portal or portals that will take you to the fifth dimension. It's part of our natural evolution. Not the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension is full of bad guys. We're going to avoid the fourth dimension. And every individual on this Earth will have to make a choice as to whether they want to advance to the next stage of development or whether they want to remain in the stage they're in now. And that's an interesting choice for everybody. In terms of your technology, no, we're not going to have an invasion. The reptilian group would like to stage an invasion. You've heard the term Illuminati. There are factions that work together with some elements of ET. And yeah, they would certainly like to have full control of the planet. But I don't think that's going to happen.
No, but it could. Do you see war or conflict?
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point of it. The whole point of it is to rout. You see, you have something we don't have. You have the right to carry arms. We lost that right a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
We don't carry arms. You guys are a real problem to people who want to destroy democracy because you have the right to bear arms. That's why America is... If America falls, the world falls. Let me put it to you like that. That's why America's the key player. That's why everything's played out in the States.
Mm-hmm.
I think that basically that 20 years ago they'd have got away with it. But now with the internet, with so many people being aware, so many people asking questions, and people being brave and not being pushed around, I think they're going to have a very hard job. And I just don't think they're going to have the manpower, basically, to lock down all your cities. I just can't see it happening. And the other important thing is there is a group of extraterrestrials who are good guys who've said enough is enough. And it's quite unprecedented that this group of extraterrestrials are now becoming involved. But generally speaking, they've let the Earth get on with it, let humanity get on with it, demonic weapon. And it's about the balance is being restored. And the key basically is to say, if humanity is no longer manipulated, what would humanity do? Are you humans evolved at a state now where you're ready to accept your place in the universe? Are you spiritually evolved enough? And until all the manipulation is removed from us, they can't judge that. So once that manipulation is removed, they'll then watch to see how we develop. And if we make it, we'll be accepted. If we don't make it, well, that's another story.
Well, all right, so this ET invasion, or whatever we want to call it, intervention, appearance, presentation, might happen when?
Within the next 5 years.
And will we, as a species, attempt to repel? Will this be, I come in peace, human beings? Or will it be, we're going to take half of your planet and get rid of half of you? We need the space. What do you think?
Let me get straight in here, because this is where things can get upsetting, and we don't need to be upset here. The ETs generally are waiting for the Earth to naturally evolve. A large proportion of the human race will naturally evolve to the next level. That will naturally depopulate the Earth. Naturally depopulate it. And it's at that point that the ETs will bring on their hybrids onto the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And those hybrids then will have a range of souls. They mm-hmm. might be human souls, they might mm-hmm. be mantid souls, reptilian souls, goodness knows what. They're not going to steal the Earth. If they wanted to steal the Earth, they would have done it when we were in the Stone Age, when we couldn't have resisted at all. But it's always been known that the Earth will evolve, and its humanity will evolve, or will have the chance to evolve. And once it naturally evolves, the Earth will be naturally depopulated, and that's when the hybrids come on. I don't want people to confuse that with a false invasion created by a small group of
yes.
very rich humans.
Yes, yes, and that's the biggest problem.
Yes.
How will we know which is which? It's going to be difficult, because the media is all controlled.
Yes.
The news will be controlled. The military will respond in whatever fashion the scenario calls for them to respond.
Yes.
And then when the real ET shows up, how
yes.
will we know? We will, in time, find out. But the initial phase of it, it's going to be very
yes.
confusing.
You're very true. You're very true. And I think it's the first 12 hours that will set the pattern. If you see images of on your television screen of ETs killing and attacking, I'm not saying don't believe it, but what I would say to your listeners is that that is not what you would be witnessing, would not be the true image. What you would be seeing is a very small stage managed, almost like in a parking lot, something filmed and put out and told it's worldwide when it isn't. What you will see if that occurs is other ETs becoming involved, and then this is the difficult part, a struggle between two sets of ETs. So it won't be ET versus humanity.
Got it.
It will be one level of ET
mm-hmm.
versus
mm-hmm.
a malevolent
mm-hmm.
ET, and that's for the battle that will be played out. In fact, to be truthful with you, this battle has been played out now for the last 12 months, but we don't often see
it. Is underway. Interesting.
Yes, it is.
Uh-huh.
It has been, and it's rather successful at the moment. A lot of the bases that were built jointly between humanity and the grey aliens are now not habitable anymore.
Because they've been destroyed.
Because they have been made uninhabitable.
Mm-hmm.
Destroyed
as living, they can't be lived in and used. All right, I got it.
No, because they had cloning facilities.
Mm-hmm.
there was an awful lot of very evil stuff going on there, and they've just been destroyed. Not with explosions, but with ultrasonic waves. It would register as an earthquake. If you were out on the Earth, you'd think you'd had an earthquake under your feet.
So these underground noises, booms, and explosions are, in fact, in some cases, representative of a war between ETs.
That's absolutely correct. And that's nothing new. The Earth has been fought over for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope the good guys win.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got my money on them.
All right. And this is all going to unfold, you say, within the next 5 years.
It is, yes. It'll be in our lifetime. Be in our lifetime. It's already happening. Look at the financial situation. It's unprecedented. Countries almost collapsing. People who have made their life about money suddenly finding that perhaps they've gone down the wrong path. This Earth is going through the most incredible changes, and I don't just mean physiological changes. I'm talking about people's values and perception. It's a wonderful time to be alive, Jeff.
Fascinating. Well, a lot of people would disagree with you, but needless to say, your perspective and vantage point is much different than most. So
okay.
We'll take that for what it's worth. That's okay. Very good news indeed. Do you expect more contactees to begin to come forward now in these times, or is it going to stay pretty much as it is until the charade begins of the ET invasion and the faux ET invasion and all of that? The idea that things are going on underneath this is certainly acceptable to many people. We have no idea what's underneath us. We don't see any of it. And there are people who talk about a vast underground caverns and complexes and bases and all the rest of it. We do have humans, tunnel boring equipment that can do just amazing things. We think that maybe this technology has been used in the U.S., for example, to set up underground maglev or some other propelled high-speed transit systems, perhaps from coast to coast. We don't know. There's talk about Denver being a nexus, massive underground cities here and there. I think and I suspect that the subterranean portion of the planet is amazingly busy.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, when my mother was doing her work on the German document, one of those documents was to build a boring machine that was nuclear-powered. So a huge, like a railroad train, but it was actually had its own nuclear power generator. And they devised it, and it could cut through rock, and it would travel at about 2 or 3 miles an hour, and it would absolutely sear the rock. And you'd have two types of, it would either be absolutely smooth, or it could be lumpy, depending on the speed that the borer went through. And this was back in the early 70s. So they have the machines to make some incredible tunnels, even back then.
Wow. All I know, it heats up the rock, turns it into a molten magma, and as the machine passes through, it cools it, and it leaves an almost obsidian glass-like wall
around it. Sprays jets of water on it from the back.
Have you been down in these tunnels?
Yes, I have. I can tell you something. I have, and I've seen fossils projecting from the rock, and you can actually, if you go down in these bases, you can actually find dinosaur bones sitting on the floor that have been collected from as they've tunneled and machines gone through. It's quite striking.
I bet.
Quite striking.
What kind of transit do you find there? Rails or something else?
No, single rail running on a repulse magnetic. Positive negative device with little cars that you sit in, and the speeds are absolutely phenomenal, but they don't have many twists and turns. They're quite straight.
You've been in these?
I've seen them. I've not been in one. I've seen them but not been in it. I think I would be too scared to go in one.
Who uses these? ETs? Humans? Both?
Both. It's to get you from one facility to another very quickly, where you might have a meeting or you need to get some equipment very quickly, and you don't want the outside world to see. You don't want to fly it, you don't want to railroad it, and you don't want to put it on a big lorry, so you can get your stuff where you need it, nobody knows about it.
Fascinating. It validates my friend Dr. Richard Sauder, who has written books about underground bases and tunnels.
Okay.
He's very careful only to publish factual data that he has been able to glean from the public record database.
I've never read anything, but do pass my address, my email address, or if you speak to him. Yes, I've seen these installations. They're fascinating. They're built jointly by humans and ET.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny because the last picture of a large tunnel boring machine was taken, I believe, in the mid-70s, and the whole technology rather disappeared, which suggests to me that what you're proposing is, and what Richard Sauder has proposed, is in fact quite accurate. Quite accurate. We have, of course, many, many stories of underground hum, experiences by residents in various cities, and all the rest of it. It's quite...
You know, Jeff, the thing that really hits me is the cost. Financial cost of all this work. I have no idea how many billions of dollars it has cost since the 1950s, but I guess if they didn't do that, then you guys would have a much higher state of living than you have now.
Well, there's an old joke, and well, it's my joke. How much money do the black operations boys and girls have? And the answer is as much as they want. Trillions.
Yeah, that's true.
We don't
know.
It's just been crazy.
It's true.
One of the things that's very interesting is how quickly the powers that be have response teams. Should there be this absurd UFO ET cover-up continues, especially in the States, and they have very well-trained response teams ready to roll any time, fly anywhere, cordon off, recover, retrieve, and all the rest of it, crashed hardware. I'm not sure where this is going. We have seemingly been given technology or back-engineered technology from downed craft for years.
Yes.
So, but there is a vested interest in keeping this whole thing covered up. Although most Americans, I think the vast majority of them, believe firmly in visitation by ET and possibly communication with and dealings with, which is what you've already alluded to. So. That's pretty much
all. You guys had Roswell.
Oh yeah, we had a lot of things like Roswell.
Yeah.
And you've had your Roswell.
You mean Bentwaters or Rendlesham?
Rendlesham Forest is your. That's as good as it gets, I think. That was quite a story.
It's different. It's time travel with Rendlesham. That's really time. Yeah.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
Well, we're running out of time now, aren't we?
We are. And time for you to get some rest, Simon. Thank you. That was absolutely delightful and fascinating. And
Listen, Jeff, keep in touch. And if you get any visit, your listeners who have any questions, please forward them on to me.
Yes. Would you hang on the phone here just for another minute or two? I want to get my producer to pass something over to you.
Sure.
So let me thank you again, and we'll talk.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
All right. And thanks to all of you for being with us tonight. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. Take care.